You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, ChristianHumanist.org.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the City of Man podcast. My name is Coyle Neal. I'm an associate professor of political science at Southwest Baptist University in Bolivar, Missouri. Just what is the role of slavery in American history? How should it be taught? Does the institution taint every aspect of American life from the earliest days of colonization until now? Or should we see it as having had a much more limited role in our past and a smaller influence on our present? In August 2019, the New York Times attempted to decisively answer these questions by announcing its 1619 Project. To help us think about the 1619 Project, we have with us today Dr. Peter Wood, former professor of anthropology and college provost, and currently president of the National Association of Scholars, and the author of the new book 1620, A Critical Response to the 1619 Project. Dr. Wood, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Great to be here.
Actually, I do want to give you a chance to do some institutional promotion. Briefly, what is the National Association of Scholars?
It's about a 30-year-old membership organization made up mostly of scholars, people like you. The idea back in the 1980s when it was created was that the rise of political correctness posed a danger to intellectual freedom, and it was going to summon together the gray heads of scholarship to say, let's cut this out, fellows, and not go down that path. That obviously failed, and National Association of Scholars, however, kept going, and we have been involved in any number of imbroglios over the years, again, trying to keep the classical virtues of American higher education alive during times when there were a lot of pressures to let those go. And we're very much now involved in trying to fight cancel culture and things like that.
And since most of our listeners are scholars, I'll assume that that's something that many of them are interested in, presumably not in being canceled, but in thinking well about cancel culture and what you guys do. Some of that relates directly to the subject of the book, but let's start with sort of an overview. What is the 1619 Project?
Well, you gave a pretty good opening on it. It was a special issue of the New York Times Sunday Magazine, issued on August 18, 2019. It was edited by a journalist named Nicole Hand Jones. It was 100 pages long, 10 major essays, and something more than that of short sidebar pieces, photographs, poetry, a kind of melange of things all lined up on the theme that America was a slaveocracy from its very beginning, the very beginning being the arrival in Jamestown in August of 1619, of the ship bringing African slaves to the English colony there. There's a lot that's misleading about that, but that's the premise. The point being that at that very moment emerged the idea of white supremacy, the privileging of the white colonists by means of their subordination of the new black arrivees, and that everything that has happened in the ensuing 400 years derives from that moment. It's treated as a moment in which slavery began in the New World, and I have to go into some depth on that, but I'll hold that for a moment. But it goes on to do such things as erase the importance of the American founding, 1776, the Revolution, were in the eyes of Nicole Hannah Jones, incidents aimed only at perpetuating slavery still further. The reason American colonists took up arms against the British was to preserve the institution of slavery, she says. The eventual wealth and prosperity of the American nation was built on plantation slavery, she says, and so do some of her colleagues. The idea that African Americans, blacks in the U.S. Struggled against this system, she presents as being wholly self-help effort. There were no white allies ever that made any difference. The picture that one gets is that everything that Americans believe is important, exceptional, noteworthy about our history is either a lie or has been grossly misinterpreted for failure to take account of the play of white supremacy against black subordination. Now, we're all familiar with this as a theme these days because of the efforts to create an anti-racist movement, and writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Mr. Kendi have been teaching us that racism is the root of everything, and a very large number of Americans, including quite a few academics, have bought into that. Well, the 1619 Project was the booster rocket that got that started. I'll pause there.
And we can get into some of the specifics, the historical specifics, which you do in the book. But how is that a different how can I ask this? How is the claim that's being made by the 1619 Project different from some of the other claims that we see in academia? I mean, historians and scholars are always pitching alternative interpretation. I mean, you have to do that to get your PhD, right? So how is what's going on at the New York Times different from, say, when some professor of history somewhere publishes a scholarly book that says, well, actually, everything needs to be read through the filter, the lens of slavery and then segregation and then racism? What's the difference in approach there?
Well, to start with, one difference is that we're talking about a newspaper and not a historical journal or monograph. Unlike the journal or the monograph, which has to proceed by presenting evidence to support its heterodox claims, if that's what they're going to be, the Times felt no compunction about just asserting the story. So there is no source material in it at all, no reference to things that you can go and check to vouchsafe that Hannah Nicole Jones' story or that of her other contributors stand on any basis of fact. So there's that. There is this issue that most of the really important claims made in the article are not just lacking in citation or visible support. They run directly counter to a massive body of well-established scholarship. So it wasn't just conservatives that took umbrage at how the American Revolution was treated. Lots of left-wing historians were on it as well. People
who socialists, right?
Socialists. people who believe that facts do matter and that to understand the past requires paying some attention to documentary sources and finding some genuinely unimpeachable evidence that something that you said occurred actually occurred. Now, let's pause there on the American Revolution. It's far from the only piece of the 1619 Project, but it gets to the heart of this problem. We have a pretty good idea of why the colonists rebelled against England. The intellectual elite of America gathered together in Philadelphia in 1776, and with the pen of Thomas Jefferson, gave us the Declaration of Independence. It's actually, apart from its opening paragraphs, a pretty dry document. It lists about 30 different grievances which the colonists had against their mother country and reasons by which the bands that were to unite us with that monarchy had to be severed. There was plenty of opportunity there to say, well, the real reason we're doing this is that we think that the crown is going to abolish slavery in America, and we just can't do without our slaves. That was not said. Nothing like it was said. So we have sort of an absence of evidence. Well, maybe you're thinking Thomas Jefferson and the other colonists really wanted to protect slavery, but dare not say it. So we could look elsewhere for sources. Well, what do we have? We have colonial newspapers from the time, and for the years before that, quite a few of them actually have survived. We have the personal letters and diaries of people living at that time. We have the recollections of the leaders of the revolution frequently written down in the ensuing decades. We can go through all that material, and we have, and there's not a whisper of anybody saying the reason we're fighting this revolution is to preserve the institution of slavery. There just is nothing there. So what do you have? You have a story that is simply made up out of thin air. That's what the 1619 Project is. And that's how you distinguish it from dissenting historians trying to present a case that some important event has been misinterpreted. Historians, as you say, are always doing that, rightly so, to get their claims at least attended to in a serious way requires bringing forth evidence to support them. You know, the hidden diary of Thomas Jefferson that lays out this case. Well, you know, we don't have that. And in the absence of information about the past, you can't just make things up and expect to be taken seriously as a historian or as a scholar.
Yeah, and I suspect that if the authors of the various essays were here, maybe not all of them, you do go through and distinguish between the different essays in the project. Which I appreciate because it's a big project and there's a lot of different authors. But if some of those authors were here, presumably what they would say is, well, look, if we look at slavery in America in the 1850s, that institution is so obviously brutal and wicked. And then we look at it not only as it existed in the 1850s, but from the perspective of the people who were in that institution. And living as their descendants, which I'm not, and the majority of Americans are not, but a large minority are, how is it not understandable that that perspective affects everything else? And isn't that worth bringing into our view of history and worth reframing our perspective of American history?
Well, I suppose the question here is exactly what perspective are you talking about? Since the 1950s, there has been dramatic change in the way American history has been told and presented. The last chapter of my book, I go through history textbooks of the 20th century. And indeed, if you go back to the 1930s and 40s, you can find textbooks that basically obliterate the Black experience. They say nothing about it, or if they say anything at all, it's demeaning. But by the 1950s, that begins to change. By the 1960s, those changes swell into a tide. By the 1970s, it's really impossible to find a textbook on American history by a major publisher that doesn't give ample space to the Black experience in America and doesn't treat slavery as a really central event in that history. So it's not as though this history has been erased. That's one of the false pretenses of the 1619 Project. The story has never been told, we're told. Well, the story has been told incessantly for the last 40 to 50 years. There is no textbook in use in America right now that overlooks it or downplays it. Among actual practicing historians of American history, this is a main theme. No matter where they are on the political spectrum, left or right, we recognize that you cannot deal honestly and fairly with American history without treating the issue of slavery and the consequences of slavery. What happened with Reconstruction, Jim Crow, and the Civil Rights Movement, that story has to be told. It is told, and it's told extremely well. That is, we're not neglecting it. What we're not doing to it, however, is turning it into a racist mythology. Racist in the sense that the whole of history now needs to be seen through the prism of people who suffered under slavery. That probably, you know, should take me back to that opening thing about how old is slavery? Is it, are we at the 401th anniversary of slavery in America? Well, no, we're not. and were not in a variety of ways. One thing was that before that ship arrived at Jamestown, slavery was already here. It had been for, well, depending on who you're looking at, either 100 years or thousands of years. The Spanish and the Portuguese had been importing African slaves for more than a century before Jamestown. Some of those slaves were in Florida and Georgia, so in states that eventually became part of the Union, it was there. There is the issue that slavery was also an indigenous institution among Native Americans who had been enslaving each other. And when Europeans came along and they were, had the opportunity to capture them, they enslaved Europeans too. Even for a while, as I recall, John Smith in Jamestown was enslaved by Indians. So the idea of slavery was not introduced in 1619. The idea of enslaving blacks was not introduced in 1619. But to cap all of this, the blacks that arrived in Jamestown in 1619 were not slaves. They had been captured as slaves by the Portuguese, sold to the Spanish, shipped to the New World, but an English pirate ship intercepted them, took some of those slaves to Bermuda, had 20-some left over, brought them to Jamestown, traded them for food. But as soon as those individuals stepped onto the shore of Virginia, they were no longer slaves because Virginia did not recognize slavery and instead had the institution of indentured servitude. Being an involuntary indentured servant, let's say, was probably no picnic, but it was a lot better than being worked to death in the mines in Mexico or on the sugar plantations in the Caribbean. The result of these individuals being turned into indentured servants was that at the end of their indenture, they were liberated. They became, in some cases, landowners. They intermarried with the white population. Slavery in Virginia lay some 40 or 50 years in the future. What we have in 1619 is this very odd situation of kind of racial integration before we had a word for it. And in any case, Nicole Hannah-Jones and the New York Times choosing that as the point at which slavery began in America is, again, just sloppy history. That's not how it happened. We may regret that it happened at all, but if you were among those slaves that were on the Spanish ship that was overtaken by the White Lion, the English pirate ship, you probably were fortunate that that happened. It meant a chance to live again rather than to die as a slave.
Well, and that that focus on 1619, I think, brings up the title of your own book, 1620. So what's going on in 1620, and why do you choose that as an alternative?
Well, I chose it tactically for the first part to have a rhetorical riposte to 1619. But in fact, something of high importance did happen in 1620. In November of that year, the ship, the Mayflower, arrived off the coast of Massachusetts near Cape Cod. And it had been intending to bring both the people we call pilgrims, plus about an equal number of non-pilgrims who had just intended to become residents of Virginia, was bringing them to the New World. They arrived late, off course, and without much in the way of provisions. The non-pilgrims, the pilgrims called them the strangers, decided at that point that their labor agreement with the English company that had sent them over was abrogated because they weren't in Virginia. And so they were free to go their own way. Quarrels were breaking out between the religious dissenters and these strangers. So they came together and negotiated an agreement, the agreement that we call the Mayflower Compact. It set up a set of rules, very brief, it's fewer than 200 words, in which they said that they were going to govern themselves. They recognized the sovereign King of England. They also recognized that they were outside his purview now, and they needed to figure out a way to accommodate each other. So they agreed that there would be no religious differences amongst them. They weren't going to quarrel over that. They were going to elect their own leaders. They were going to establish their own laws. And thus they proceeded. Now, they did not have an easy time of it. When in December they finally got off the ship at Plymouth and began to build their colony. They were sick. About half of the company died in that first winter, but they stuck by the terms of the Mayflower Compact, which makes that document the first charter that we have in the New World of a self-governing community. That's its importance. It is a early sign of what eventually the nation would turn into with the Declaration of Independence, a recognition of the capacity of people to put aside aristocracy and the rules of class and to treat one another as jural equals, to recognize a form of religious freedom. These were the seeds of American identity, and they didn't just sprout once and die in Plymouth. Plymouth was remembered and became a model for the settlement, first of the backcountry of New England and eventually the rest of America. So we have maybe mythologized the story of the Pilgrims and their treaties with the Native Americans of the time, but behind that mythology lies a real core of fact. They were people who wrote a lot of things down. So unlike Jamestown, we have a very rich documentary record of what happened in 1619 and the following years. And what happened there was the birth of the idea that Americans could govern themselves. I don't want to neglect that something happened in Virginia in 1619 that's noteworthy as well, which is that the colony was directed by its masters back in England to establish a legislature, and the House of Burgesses, which has a fair claim to be America's first House of Representation, came into being. Its members were basically chosen by the company, so it's not exactly the ideal form of democracy, but it is a benchmark event in American history not to be neglected.
Now again, this is it's not a rabbit trail from your book, but if I'm one of the authors of the 1619 Project, my response to that is going to be, look, the events of 1620, the writing of the Mayflower Compact, and even to some extent, the founding of the House of Burgesses in Virginia in 1619, those don't impact African Americans nearly as much as the institution of chattel slavery, whatever year that happens, right? Whatever year you want to start, whether it's 1619 or 40 years later, or the invention of the cotton gin. I mean, whenever you put that, that is the institution that affects so much more of every aspect of our lives. So why shouldn't we focus on the reality that all of those promises of the Mayflower Compact, of the Declaration of Independence that you mentioned, of even of the Constitution itself, are denied to a large group of people in the nation from then at least until the Civil Rights era? And then we could talk about systemic racism and argue about whether or not that's ongoing today.
Well, that would be a debate worth having. I would note, first of all, that the progenitors of the 1619 Project are in no mood to debate. Their approach has been simply to assert this, and that's that. But if the debate that you imagine were to take place, I would say something like this, that slavery in the British colonies of North America was among the mildest forms of slavery that existed in the New World. Millions of people were worked to death in the Caribbean sugar plantations and in Brazil and in Mexico. The fate of slaves brought from Africa to the New World was horrific, especially outside the New World. Even when slavery was established in the British colonies, it was done so under a form of a rule of law. Slaves were not treated as having no rights. They were given some minimal rights. Now, of course, slave masters oftentimes abused those rights. Slavery was a horrific institution here. One has to have a capacity to understand that even among horrific institutions, some are more horrific than others. American slavery was not as bad as it was in some other places. But more important than that, American slavery grew up in the shadow of a set of legal ideals derived ultimately from the Magna Carta and English common law that militated against the legal system that we had, and the ideals that lay behind that legal system were taken seriously. That's why when our Constitution was written, we had these ferocious fights over how to prevent slavery from being eternalized as an institution. So can African Americans look back over this history today and say, we had it really hard, much harder than the descendants of European colonists? And the answer to that would be, yes, you did. But had your ancestors arrived in Brazil or Jamaica, you wouldn't be here to tell this story at all. What happened instead was that over a period of a few hundred years, Americans rallied to their higher principles. This nation invented a abolitionist movement in its own right, which gained moral and legal force. We fought a civil war. It's hard to find anywhere else in the whole world where a country has laid down some 600,000 lives to bring about the end of this pernicious institution. We did, and slavery was brought to an end. Now, all of that seems to me to call for some kind of balance sheet where we're looking at slavery as something that was bad and that no one defends, but we're also looking at a country that took steps to abolish slavery and guarantee full legal rights to everyone who had suffered under it. The people who did suffer under it and who were manumitted, who gained their freedom with the passage of the 14th Amendment or earlier with the Emancipation Proclamation, they fully realized what they were getting. This was for them a step into genuine freedom, that there were more steps to be taken beyond that. We know is high in the consciousness of everyone who had been a slave. The pursuit of education, for example, when one reads Up from Slavery, the memoir begins with how extremely important it was to grab hold of education and be, make something of oneself. That's the theme of African American history, roughly for the almost 100 years following abolition of slavery, a seeking of uplift and genuine accomplishment of the possibilities of freedom. It's only in the last 40 to 50 years that we've got this idea that slavery so dented the souls of those who had suffered it that their descendants under the fifth and sixth generation now are helpless and hapless and continue to suffer from white supremacy. I don't buy it. I think that there are injustices in America. Racism is a real thing, but the forces that immiserate the Black community, to the extent that they exist at all, are now no longer the force of slavery. What we are watching playing out of is the failure of the great society and the welfare state.
Yeah, I can't comment on that. That's not my area of scholarship. I do wish there were some way to balance all of this out, to both argue that the historical interpretation, to be accurate in our historical approach, which is of course is what you're arguing in the book, and then to respect the sensibilities of the people who feel and not illegitimately feel that the nation has historically been against them, and how to bring all of those things into conversation, into alignment, I think is certainly something beyond my ability to do, but the challenge of the modern era in some ways.
Well, I believe that is the conversation we should be having. I'm finding that the current doctrine of anti-racism does not welcome that conversation. It is much more focused on presenting a doctrinaire answer that obliterates the need for evidence and for dispute.
Yeah, if you're interested in coming back on and talking about the How to Be an Anti-Racist book, that could be an interesting conversation. I've not read it yet, So I have to hold off comment at this point. My knowledge is limited to Facebook and Twitter comments, and those are never a good place to start a conversation.
That's not the scholarly work, right?
Well, you proceed through the book. So each chapter has a different date associated with it. We don't have time to talk about all of them, but just to grab a couple of the chapters that I found fairly compelling. In the chapter on 1775, you go into a conversation. Well, conversation again, as you pointed out, they're not really always interested in a conversation, but a back and forth between especially leftist historians. Willents, I believe, was the historian's name.
Yes, John.
And the not so much the authors of the 1619 Project as the New York Times editor, that ultimately leads to some changes in the project. So if you go to the Pulitzer website now and download the materials, they're not the same materials that came out a year and a half ago. Can you talk a little bit about that? It was a fascinating overview of this back and forth.
Well, when Sean Willents and ultimately about 20 historians came forward and asked the New York Times to make some corrections, they did so in a sober and polite manner. Initially didn't get any answer at all, and then got a brush off. Jake Silverstein was the editor who responded to this, and basically said, no, we're not making any changes. That was in January of 2020. And that remained the New York Times's position, no matter how egregious the errors were and how well documented the complaints were. The Times did nothing at all. Mid-year, Leslie Harris, a historian from Northwestern University, came forward in Politico, announcing that she had been one of the fact checkers the New York Times had used, and had told the Times in advance of publication of the 1619 Project that these claims about the American Revolution were false. She says that she was surprised after it was published that not only did they leave those claims in, but that Nicole Hannah-Jones was speaking publicly about them. But she kept her mouth shut. Now, Professor Harris is herself Black, and I believe there was an element of awkwardness in trying to go against what appeared to be a consensus view. Now, this is what we're going to say. But ultimately, her scholarly scruples came to the fore, and she admitted all of this. At that point, the Times did see fit to make a correction, though a rather odd one. It went back to the sentence in which Nicole Hannah-Jones had written that the colonists had risen against the crown to protect slavery, and amended it by adding two words. Some of the colonists did this. Well, to our knowledge, none of the colonists did, but some of, I suppose, allows the Times to imagine that somewhere, maybe in the backwoods of Kentucky, there was a man who picked up his musket and said, by golly, I'm gonna fight to maintain slavery. We don't know about that person. He's never made it into the historical records, but that's where the Times went with this. That was its standing position until September of last year, when the White House called a conference which was held at the National Archives. I was one of the speakers there, and so was President Trump. The outcome of this was that the Times had been using the 1619 Project as a kind of club by which to beat Trump over the head. He was being characterized as a racist, and his supporters as white Yahoo racist, and so forth. I think that the Times expected the 1619 Project to be a key instrument in driving the campaign to unseat Trump from the presidency. At this event in September, Trump turned it around on them and said, no, what's going on here is a destruction of real American history. So he announced the creation of a 1776 commission, which was going to present ways in which a more valid American history, patriotic history, as he called it, could be taught. He didn't actually get around to appointing that commission until December, and it kind of dribbled off into not much because President Biden, on Inauguration Day, abolished it.
But that's a generous way to put it, I think. They did release a document. And
on 2 days before inauguration, they released a preface to their report, and that's as far as it got. The the Times, however, appears, here we enter something of a realm of speculation, because I'm not in the editorial suite of the New York Times, but suddenly changes started to be made in the digital version of the 1619 project. And an alert reader who had held on to the original print version of it started to notice that they were watering down some of the more audacious and counterfactual claims, trying to phrase things more cautiously. So eventually a new slightly watered down version of the 1619 project found its way into circulation. The Times did this without any acknowledgement of error. There was no erratum published or public announcement. So it was stealth editing, which is in the world of journalism not considered to be a very praiseworthy thing. But the stealth editing did not come by means of the pressure of academic historians to tell a straight story. It came by fear that President Trump was going to make hay of their falsehoods.
We're coming up on, I think, about 30 minutes, 40 minutes. Is there before we talk about the application of this, the 1619 project in American high school classrooms, any of the other potential dates that you talk about? So you talk about the 1860s, you talk about 1776, of course, you talk about you talk about 2020 quite a bit. Any of those that you want to specifically highlight?
Well, I suppose January 1863, that's the chapter that deals with President Lincoln's meeting with some African Americans at the White House, in which he floated the idea that after the slaves had been liberated, they could be offered the opportunity of moving out of the United States to a colony that America would finance and help establish. Nicole Hannah Jones treats this as a really important moment. As the mask comes off Lincoln, he's not the great liberator, he's a man who doesn't really believe in equal rights or citizenship for blacks. He just wants to get rid of them. And the war is all about that. She cherry picks some other quotes from Lincoln's past to support that. But she also presents this event as one in which the African Americans invited to the White House would have responded to Lincoln's idea with astonishment and disgust that he would bring such a thing up. So I went back to the transcript of the meeting with Lincoln and these others, because Lincoln actually invited an independent reporter to the meeting who took scrupulous notes, and we have that record. Well, what Nicole Hannah Jones has to say is this isn't true, that that group of black leaders liked the idea, and they endorsed it. But then shortly after that, the Battle of Antietam had changed Lincoln's idea of what was possible. The Emancipation Proclamation in its first form was issued, to be followed several months later with the official version of it. So the idea of exiling blacks abroad was something that was floated and disappeared. That idea itself had been not just a brainchild of Abraham Lincoln, in play roughly since 1815, when abolitionist societies were trying to figure out what to do. And I had a lot of support in the black community. There were, even up until the 1920s with Marcus Garvey, the idea that let's go back to Africa. So it wasn't exactly an insulting idea that this could happen. The colony of Liberia was created to that extent. Lincoln was thinking of sending people to an island off the coast of Panama. But presidents come up with ideas and they drop them. And this particular event, which Nicole Hannah Jones uses to essentially undermine Lincoln's reputation in its entirety, there are some facts in there. A meeting did take place. Lincoln did broach the idea, but it really is not the spotlight that tells us who he is. Well, why is that important? In the summer of 2020, when riots were rampaging cities and towns across America, one of the targets of those riots were statues of Abraham Lincoln, which were toppled and spray painted with 1619. Nicole Hannah Jones came forward to say that she believed these were the 1619 riots, and she welcomed them. So I think the demolition of Lincoln's reputation, like that of many other important American historical figures, stems from this new nihilistic history where you can make things up and demonize people who aren't around themselves.
Or people who are.
Or people who are.
in our last few minutes that Zoom will give us here, I think this is in your last chapter, although it's been a few days since I finished the book. You talk about the use of this not just as journalism, because the 1619 Project is not just intended to be an edition of the New York Times Magazine and then the end of it, but rather it was intentionally sent around to high schools around the country. It's intended to be used as curriculum. Lesson plans are included. The Pulitzer Center, I think, really kind of jumped on that and has helped in spreading it. Can you talk a little bit about the project as a pedagogical one?
Well, I think that's actually its primary purpose. The Times contracted with the Pulitzer Center, which is not the Pulitzer that gives out the Pulitzer Prize, a separate thing. They contracted with the Pulitzer Center to be a promotional tool. And the Pulitzer Center has been not only marketing this to individual teachers, but to school districts and leaders of school districts. It had been sort of put into the water supply even before it reached print. And the Pulitzer Center early on began to boast about how quickly it was being taken up. Several really major school districts like Chicago and Buffalo adopted it wholesale. That doesn't mean that's the only history they were teaching, but it was being integrated with the rest of their history programs. Thousands of individual teachers were taking it up. Just about a month or so ago, the Pulitzer Center had announced that it was giving fellowships to teachers who would agree to adopt it and promote it. So this is an ongoing project of a very large amount of money, hard to estimate, but many millions have been spent to market this into schools. Not that they have to buy it, everything's being made free. This is a way to change the course of the way history is taught to young people, not just high school. There are versions of this that go all the way into elementary schools. Since then, we've gotten used to the idea of critical race theory and other variants of the same idea are in play now. And a kind of movement of the moment is a new civics in which this stuff is kneeled to our sense of who we are as people. There's a lot more to be said about that, but what's happened is the 1619 Project was the first draft of a radicalization of our history through the lens of racial oppression. And if you know about racial oppression, you know pretty much everything that you need to know. Everything else is just detail that can be filled in later.
Yeah, some of the cultural back and forth on this has been really fascinating to watch. Here in Missouri, the state legislature, and I don't know where this is in the process, but the the state legislature is debating a provision to ban the 1619 Project materials from our public schools. So the fact that the legislature sees fit to take it up and argue it shows you that it's gotten some traction. I mean, I suppose someone's just using it as a campaign point. That's certainly possible as well. But
well, I would say banning it, I don't know. It's pretty much impossible to ban ideas because
sure.
This could be taken out as something that shouldn't be a formal part of the curriculum, but it's been made present in a variety of other ways in the minds of history teachers all across the country. So if you stop downloading the material from the Pulitzer Center, you're probably still going to be teaching students the core ideas of this thing, for better right. or worse. I think mostly for worse.
And I think it's interesting that you're and I think this is both a strength and a limitation. So one of the problems of your book is you're writing a book. You're writing a book to respond to a set of ideas that have been provided for free. So your book, it's exactly what a book should be, right? It's footnoted, it's well-researched, it's careful, it's thoughtful. It presents, I think, both sides fairly evenly, even though you come down on one side. You're competing on a different field, if that's a fair way to put it. So what is the I mean, I guess you're free to disagree with me on that, but I think it's two different approaches. What is the proper way to engage with something like the 1619 Project, given that they're not interested in footnotes, they're not interested in the kind of scholarly approach that you're taking here. And again, I don't even want to say, as you don't say in the book, I don't even want to say that they have no good points to make, because there clearly are some important things being said. What's the right way to engage?
Well, I think the right way for people of goodwill to engage is to be concerned about gaining knowledge. You beat ignorance by knowledge. And at some level, even people who are not particularly interested in what they learned in history classes or in reading books about history do have some sense of themselves as historical actors. They want to know the truth of that. They don't want to be living a life of lies or illusions. Most people, given the choice, want the red pill. and the fact is that it's within our personal capacity to do something about that. Maybe it comes down to simply listening to a podcast like this, or I've done over 100 some radio interviews across the country about it. I'm reaching somebody apparently who wants to hear about this because the radio producers keep coming back and asking for more. So the few words that I can get across in an interview or a podcast might just be the invitation to maybe go out and read a little bit about our nation's past, even if it's only to sit down and read the Declaration of Independence or the Gettysburg Address. You're getting somewhere towards a sense that there's a real history there to be told. We academics are maybe the easy ones to sell on the idea that knowledge is better than ignorance. But I think that there is a real thirst among Americans to know stuff. What are the most popular nonfiction books in America? They're history books. You can go into a Barnes & Noble and there's shelves and shelves and shelves. They're not there for adornment. They're because people want to know something. And they want to feel connected to the actual past, not to a mythological past. Now, it's true that fantasy books and Marvel comics sell well as well, but very few people think that the gods of the Norsemen or something are the real story of who they are. What does matter is that we are people, Black, white, Hispanic, Asian, who have a shared history coming together in this nation to try, despite sometimes really formidable obstacles to govern ourselves in a civilized way, to respect the freedom and dignity of others, create a nation that's founded on those principles. So what do I hope with a book like this? Oh, it's one more little piece of kindling added to what I hope will be a bright fire of learning that will reinvigorate America during a time when we're way too willing to entertain ideas that our nation is hateful from the start and has never been anything but a process by which the strong have oppressed the weak. So I'd like us to get us past that. Anything I can do to help it, I think is to the good.
Well, and again, I think this is a fascinating book, well-written, an engaging read, and I will encourage our listeners to go out and pick it up and join in on the conversation between 1619 and 1620. Dr. Wood, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate having you here.
All right. I love the conversation. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, listeners, for tuning into the City of Man podcast. The City of Man is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our press liaison is Kristen Filippik. Please check out the other podcasts in our family and get more information about this show or our show notes by visiting christianhumanist.org. Please also leave us a review on iTunes to help other people find our show, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/cityofmanpodcast, or get in touch with us at cityofmanpodcast@gmail.com. This is Coyle Neal reminding you to render unto Caesar those things that are Caesar's, and render unto God those things that are God's.
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking that ribbon of high